Welcome to Deep Dive into Water Safety. We started the show because of a 2025 water safety plan for Hawaii that identified some startling statistics that we have the second highest drowning rate in the country, that drowning is the number one cause of death for Hawaiian children. Less than 2% of Hawaii's first graders have the basic skills to avoid or recover from drowning. And although Native American and Pacific Islanders make up 27% of Hawaii's population, they make up 36% of resident drowning deaths. 90% of snorkeling incidents are visitors, and 61% of water-related emergencies in Hawaii, a bystander is the first person on the scene. And why are we doing this show? We've been doing it for the last 4 months. We've interviewed local, national, and international experts that all have given very valuable information to our audience. And we all know, and the message is, drowning is preventable. So today, we've been really honored to have someone who has national and international expertise on the area of drowning and drowning prevention. His name is Dr. Justin Semsrott. He's an emergency physician, ocean lifeguard, and internationally recognized leader in drowning prevention, lifeguard medicine, and global water safety training. He's the executive director of Lifeguards Without Borders, a member of the International Drowning Research Alliance, and has collaborated extensively with Professor Mike Tipton on drowning physiology, rescue science, global drowning, and global drowning prevention initiatives. That's a lot. So, welcome, Dr. Justin, because I didn't want to get your name, last name wrong again, that I practiced with you just before we started the show. I really appreciate you coming on because you have a lot to offer our listeners, which are people like me that are not water experts, and then people who are experts who are in our community and listening locally, and we stream all over the world from KKCR. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Margaret. I'm very happy to be here.
Could you tell us, which I saw on a YouTube you did a couple of years ago with Dr. Drill, for the CPR Foundation, how you got involved with all this? It's very interesting in terms of your experience and where you are now in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up as a military brat overseas in the Philippines, and we were always around water, always around the ocean and the kind of the disasters of typhoons and floods and loss of power were kind of normal to me as a kid. And so I grew up with a constant awareness of that. And then in my middle school years, moved to Florida. And then at 15, 16, while trying to find myself, wound up chatting with the beach lifeguard recruiters in Jacksonville Beach, Florida. And I was a scrawny little long-haired brat trying to learn how to surf, and thought that that would be a great opportunity to get more exposure to the ocean. And that really built that lifelong foundation. And as I continued to work as a beach lifeguard there, finishing undergrad with the intent of going pre-med, I didn't apply to medical school because I just wanted to be a lifeguard forever, and decided to not go to medical school. And as I was trying to kind of work my way up the career ladder and got my EMT and my firefighter and was in paramedic school with a couple other lifeguards and supervisors. And by then I'd been at the beach for about 10 years, and the paragraph in the paramedic textbook on drowning didn't match our practical experience. And when the three of us raised our hand to say, "Hey, that doesn't match our experience," then we were told, "Well, that's what's in the textbook, so that's what happens." And that was kind of that moment that pushed me forward to say, "You know what? Maybe I should go to medical school so that I can better understand this and then find a way to translate it from that physician level all the way down to the paramedics and even the 16-year-old seasonal lifeguard in the stand in a practical way that that makes sense. And so from there, applied to medical school and was fortunate enough to get in, but went with the specific intent of doing emergency medicine and focusing on the spectrum of prevention, rescue, and treatment of drowning.
That's amazing. And it shows with all the work that you're involved in. I mean, what we're going to talk with is a lot to unpack in what you've done. And Mike Tipton is the person people are going to say, Margaret, how did you find this person? It was Mike Tipton. And Mike Tipton came on the show and he had a great impact on our listeners. We, even the junior lifeguards here in Kauai, became part of the UK's program on Find Your Float. And everybody started talking about water survival and floating. So that was a great piece. And so you're the next piece of this puzzle. So I want to talk about your science and research. You co-authored the Drowning Timeline Model. Can you walk us through the stages and explain why thinking of drowning as a process rather than a single event changes both rescue and medical response?
Yeah, absolutely. And it goes down to more of our modern understanding of drowning. When most people hear drowning, they just think of death. Drowning equals somebody has died in the water. And if they're already dead, then what is there for us to do? And so the idea behind the drowning timeline was to really emphasize that drowning is a process, and we can interrupt that process at any time to hopefully turn it into a rescue instead of a death. And most of us know someone who has had a heart attack or stroke and may or may not have survived. And we wouldn't say that somebody who survived a heart attack or stroke had a near heart attack or a near stroke. Similarly, there's no near drowning. And so by thinking of drowning along that continuum, then we can prevent, rescue, and treat it. And the drowning timeline really breaks the drowning process into pre-event, event, and post-event. And most of the work the way that has the most impact in drowning is on that pre-event phase, identifying the communities or the individuals that are at risk, doing the prevention messaging, use of life jackets, engineering systems to make water and water access safer. And then the event itself is the purview often of lifeguards and bystanders performing that rescue. And then once prevention has failed and a rescue has been performed, then that post-event or treatment side is how do we give that person the best chance of survival anywhere along that continuum?
So, what are people talking about when they say dry drowning or secondary drowning? Could you explain that and why these terms are misleading and what the evidence really shows?
Yeah, so neither of those terms have an acceptable or an accepted medical definition, and they're often used in confusing and conflicting ways, even throughout the published medical literature. And for decades, we've known that sometimes somebody goes in the water, they get water into their lungs, they come out of the water, they may or may not be conscious, and they later survive, or they later die. And when we think of drowning just as death, then that kind of creates that glitch in our brains of like, well, how did they drown and survive? And so the idea of this dry drowning or delayed drowning is that somebody would come out of the water having taken just a little bit of water into their lungs, who then may later die. And the reality is, those people, when they come out of the water, have some amount of symptoms. Sometimes they can be subtle and not obvious because they're still conscious, but they're having some confusion, some signs of lack of oxygen to the brain, a persistent cough, or difficulty breathing. And then most of the time, those symptoms kind of go away on their own. 95 to 99% of the time, that's the case. But 1 to 5% of the time, that will continue to get worse over the next couple hours. And the old way of thinking was if it's salt water, if it's fresh water, then the water from the body is going, or the fluid from the body is going to flood into the lungs and they're going to die mysteriously 24 to 48 hours later. And the reality is these people get better or worse over the next 2 to 4 hours. And even in the emergency departments, that's usually how long we watch them to see, okay, they haven't required any oxygen, they're getting better, they're safe to go home. So the several things that that brings up for me is the analogy to the definitions of concussion, right? When I was a kid and you had a concussion, we just said, you got your bell rung, go back in there. But now, if we tell a parent, your child has had a traumatic brain injury that puts them at a lifelong risk for chronic traumatic encephalopathy, do you want us to put them back in this peewee football game? Of course not, right? Because we know that there are consequences to it. And if we can better educate parents on what is drowning, your child came out of the water and they weren't acting right, bring them to their doctor, bring them to the emergency department. We're happy to see them. In fact, this non-fatal drowning is far more common than fatal drowning. Depending on the study design and where around the world it is, anywhere from 4 to 10 non-fatal drownings for every fatal drowning. And so the idea that this dry drowning or delayed or secondary, I'm using air quotes for those on the radio, drowning is this rare, mysterious thing. It's actually 4 to 10 times more common than fatal drowning. And we see 10 to 13,000 non-fatal drowning patients in emergency departments every year in the US alone. And by increasing that education and awareness for parents, it's no longer this scary boogeyman to keep your child out of the water. It's here's what to look out for. If your child has been roughhousing, if they fell in unintentionally at the pool party and somebody pulled them out and they're still conscious, well, they could still be drowning, even though they're conscious and crying. Bring them to the hospital. And the elevator pitch that I always give to parents and to groups is we've all been at the table and had some water go down the wrong pipe. That's your protective airway reflexes, keeping air out of, or sorry, keeping water out of your lungs. And if you pull somebody out of the water and their symptoms last longer than what you would expect at the dinner table, bring them to the emergency department, take them to the hospital, and we're happy to see them. But if you choke on a little bit of water at the dinner table, you still finish the dinner. You still go about the night, and in a couple of minutes, you're 100% back to normal. And if that's the case, then expect that they're going to go back to normal. And then my last thought on it is, I never want to be considered as discouraging parents from seeking care if they're worried about their child, because I've seen numerous cases where something is attributed to this air quote dry, delayed, or secondary drowning, when in reality, it was a spontaneous collapsed lung. It was a bad infection of the heart. It was a pneumonia. It was an infection in the gallbladder. But because they were swimming a few days ago, the focus was on, oh, do they have this weird, scary, mysterious thing? If your child's not acting right several days after being in the water, they're not acting right. You're their parent. You know them better than the doctors and nurses. Take them in for an evaluation, but it's probably not a result of being in the water. It may be something else.
Okay, so that's really good information. So, how can this relate? How can this relate to CPR training and what you know about compressions and all that right now in terms of drowning, if you're learning that?
Yeah, so a little bit of a historical perspective, and That's part of the reason why I love some of these long form discussions, is that CPR, when I was younger, in the 90s and early 2000s, really focused on doing compressions and rescue breaths. But rescue breaths can be doing mouth to mouth, mouth to mask can be technically difficult. And if we look at the big picture of about 300,000 out of hospital cardiac arrests every year in the US, so that's your from trauma, from drowning, from sudden cardiac arrest, from kidney failure, from diabetes, from everything, about a quarter of those are caused by an electrical disturbance in the heart that can be treated with an AED. So from a public health perspective, that 25% is the easiest to treat for a bystander, because the treatment is compression-only CPR and using an AED to shock them back into a normal rhythm as early as possible. And so part of the reason why that mid to late 2000s shift in CPR education came, because from a public health standpoint, this was the easiest to teach. And many people had that barrier of, I don't want to take a CPR class because I don't want to do mouth to mouth on a stranger. And so if we empower them to do compression only CPR until an AED arrives, then that is amazing. The asterisk is that only treats sudden cardiac arrest from those electrical disturbances called VF and VT. So now somebody that's drowning, who has an otherwise healthy, normal heart, who's underwater, their oxygen level starts to drop 100%, 75%, 50%, 0%. At some point, the heart runs out of enough oxygen to keep beating. So when you pull them out of the water, if you're doing compression only CPR, you're only circulating blood that has no oxygen. So you have to do breaths and compressions. And that's both for professional rescuers and for parents, soccer moms and dads, accountants and lawyers that are taking CPR classes. And one of the big take-home messages that I always give to parents is, we see many fire departments, workplaces, at the airport, right? Teach anyone CPR in 15 minutes, this 1 hour community CPR class. Corporate brings in the local fire department to do it on a catered lunch break. And that is wonderful if you're learning CPR for your spouse, for your parent that's living with you, for some of those other populations. Yes, this happens to young people as well, but predominantly that's for an older po aging population. If you're taking a CPR class because you have a pool, because you have children, then you need to take the full weekend course that includes instruction on how to do breaths and compressions, because that's the CPR that's needed both in the hospital, pre-hospital, and bystander settings for drowning for kids. And I love the giving the analogy of, you can imagine if my heart has stopped because all of my blood is outside of my body from a traumatic injury. No amount of chest compressions and AED are going to restart my heart. You have to put blood back in. So if my heart has stopped because I'm out of oxygen, no amount of compression only and an AED is going to restart my heart without putting that oxygen back in also.
That is such a wonderful message, and I commend them for doing CPR to get it out to more people, because you're right, people are uncomfortable with the breaths. But we live in Hawaii, surrounded by water, and most of the drownings are happening in water. So I don't want the assumption to be that they took a CPR course, so now they can just do compressions on this person that they drag out of the ocean. This was, to me, when I listened to one of your other interviews, just astounding to me. Somebody I know, Pat Durkin, who is a water safety person here, has also said the same thing, that there's an asterisk to that, that you need to be telling people this is not going to work on somebody that has just drowned or has been in one of those incidents. So I appreciate for you coming on and actually telling us this again. And so thank you.
Yeah, and part of it is so difficult because this is that perfect intersection where to address and truly prevent drowning, you have to involve multiple sectors. It can't just be the medical community because we can have this perfect science that doesn't translate into practice. And sometimes we need to make it. Sometimes, perfect is the enemy of good. And if we can just do something and give people something to do, then that's often better than doing nothing. And one of the difficult things around this is even though we know CPR for drowning requires breaths and compressions, giving rescue breaths to a drowned person is a technically difficult task that requires practice, training, and retraining. Amplify that by if you're a non-medical person and it's your niece, your nephew, your cousin, your child that's been pulled out of the water, and now you're at the most emotionally difficult time of your life. Your adrenaline is through the roof, your heart rate is through the roof, and you're trying to remember how to do this task or take it one step further. We know that 911 dispatchers giving CPR instruction over the phone to untrained persons saves lives. Period, full stop. Right? That is well studied. The difficult thing is it's darn near impossible to give good rescue breath instruction to an untrained person over the phone. And so if the option is do nothing or do compression only CPR, then our dispatchers are guiding compression only CPR, right? If that's all the parent knows, if that's all the bystanders know is compression only CPR, it's definitely not going to cause harm. And there's a small chance it causes some benefit. So do something,
I see.
right? Don't let perfect be the enemy of good, right? I never learned how to give rescue breaths, therefore I'm going to do nothing, right?
Right.
If all you learned was compression only CPR, then do that. It's better than doing nothing. It's not harmful and maybe beneficial. Doing nothing is definitely harmful. So, we have to find and meet people where they are once this comes into practice. Now, again, for our professional rescuers, they're held to a different standard. They should be doing the right thing. And, I'm sure we'll talk more about that later. But for the bystanders, right, we can't let perfect be the enemy of good.
Okay, so in regular, just normal people doing a CPR course and learning breaths, is there something that can be taught for people to, so they'd understand about the drowning piece, or is it much more difficult to learn? Is that what you're saying?
No, not necessarily. It's that, yes, take the course. Yes, learn the rescue breaths. But if you find yourself in that situation and you don't remember what to do, you don't think that you're doing it right, it's okay to fall back to that compression only. And that was one of the difficult things with general population CPR instruction in the late 90s and early 2000s was there were different numbers to remember, there were different ratios to remember for adults, for kids. And we know that under duress, math is one of the first skills that goes out the window, right?
Right.
Recall of numbers, right? Nobody rises to the occasion. Everybody falls back to their level of training. And if you took that one CPR class once as an accountant 7 years ago, and now you're having to use it, you may not be doing it perfectly. And that's okay. Do the best that you can, which may just be doing compression only instead of nothing.
That's Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. So, tell me something. You've helped develop EMS drowning protocols. What are the most important first steps when paramedics or lifeguards receive a drowning patient?
So for out of hospital cardiac arrest caused by our, the hearts of our aging population, it used to be very chaotic, right? Paramedics and EMTs would often say that was the most exciting, most thrilling call of the day because it was absolute chaos. And in that chaos, we didn't do a great job. Our chest compressions were inconsistent. Our use of the defibrillator was inconsistent. And so, about 15 years ago, there was a big push in EMS towards what we call like pit crew, thinking of a NASCAR or a Formula One team. Everybody has a specific job, they know what their job is. Or this team, or we call it team-focused CPR, where for out-of-hospital cardiac arrest from presumed cardiac causes, the lifeguards, the paramedics, they know the first person there starts chest compressions. The second person brings in the AED. The third person in brings in the oxygen or the monitor, whatever, however it goes for that specific system. And we've gotten really good. And there are numerous studies that show how that has improved out-of-hospital cardiac arrest survival. So now, how do we translate that to drowning? Because applying that exact same protocol and algorithm to a drowning patient from a professional rescuer standpoint doesn't address that underlying problem of lack of oxygen to the brain. And so as I've worked with different EMS agencies, sometimes at the state level, to improve these protocols, it's to increase that emphasis on when you're the first person there, when you're the first person out of the back of the ambulance, out of the back of the truck, off the tower, you need to be the person that has the bag valve mask or the oxygen in your hand and just go start giving that person breaths. Right. And a lot of the older CPR paradigms called for two rescue breaths. And starting in 2011, the European Resuscitation Council and numerous other agencies, we started pushing for five rescue breaths. And we don't know the perfect number. Is four the best? Is six the best? It's an impossible study design to really try and figure out. So we don't know that two is necessary or five is necessarily better than two, but we do know that emphasizing and prioritizing giving rescue breaths will reframe how those responders are treating instead of treating this like a regular out of hospital VFib VTach cardiac arrest. And so many of the agencies that I work with, we emphasize that as soon as you meet the patient, just start giving them five rescue breaths. If they reach up and tell you to stop, great. Right? Now you know that you can de-escalate to an oxygen mask. Right. But we're not spending a lot of time checking for a pulse and then starting, 30 chest compressions before we then get to that first rescue breath, because as professional rescuers, we don't want to delay that.
Is that something that's been accepted nationwide or internationally as a standard?
So the European Resuscitation Council guideline is for five rescue breaths, and most of the military special forces medics have moved towards a five rescue breath model, and a lot of other big county and state agencies have moved towards that. In the recent CPR guidelines, there's an acknowledgement that we don't know the exact number. And we don't know if giving that first, the rescue breaths first, improves survival over doing the chest compressions first. Because again, it's really difficult to study. And the reality is, 5, 6, 8 minutes into this, it may not matter what you did initially. Because if you started with the 30 compressions and then gave two rescue breaths, then you're delaying the rescue breaths by about, 25, 20 to 30 seconds. and it may not be possible to measure that difference. So it's really about changing the emphasis in training and response of, okay, here's my number one priority is to get oxygen to the brain to interrupt that drowning process. And by starting with those five rescue breaths, then that's going to help frame what I need to do in those initial few seconds on scene. And then everything else, falls in behind me.
You mentioned in another interview about the amount of time that a rescuer should respond to a situation based on research. Can you talk about that after a drowning, how long they've been in the water and those time frames?
Yeah, so it's difficult. And again, you can imagine for obvious reasons, we don't have studies where we hold people underwater and say, okay, it took this person this long to die. And this is the survival at 72 seconds versus 73 versus 74 versus 100 seconds. And so when we retrospectively look at here's the big group of people that drown with a known submersion time less than 5 to 6 minutes. Those almost all survive, more than 80% survive neurologically intact. And water temperature, age don't necessarily matter. All that matters is how long were they underwater. If we take those same big studies and say, okay, let's make it everybody under 10 minutes. So that includes the 1 minutes, the 4 minutes, and the 8 minutes all kind of grouped together. When the person has been known to be under for less than 10 minutes, about three quarters survive without brain damage versus only 4% if it's greater than 10 minutes. And so that is one of the reasons why so many of the lectures and so much of the teaching that I do is to parents, lifeguards, and first responders, because by the time they get to me in the hospital as a physician, they had their time underwater, plus the initial time on the beach, plus the time in the back of the ambulance, and it's been 40, 60 minutes by the time they get to me. And the brain is so sensitive to that lack of oxygen that that it really is interrupting that drowning process in those first few minutes. And part of the reason why bystanders and lifeguards are so important is you can imagine if somebody's only been underwater for 2 minutes and you pull them out, and now they're on the beach, they're on the side of the pool, but not getting oxygen to the brain for another 8 minutes until the ambulance arrives. Well, they may as well have just been underwater for 10 minutes, right? Because they're out of the water but not breathing. So as far as the brain is concerned, they're still drowning. And then it's widely variable from 10 to 15 minutes, I'm sorry, from 10 to 25 minutes. And then greater than 25 minutes of known submersion time is almost universally fatal or bad outcomes, meaning just, neurologically devastated, completely reliant on others for all activities.
That information that I listened to that you just restated was, I thought, very important. All parents should have that information. Everybody should have that information. Not having oxygen for that long a time when maybe we could have done something, was amazing to me. I had no idea.
Yeah, and for me, it's easy for me to kind of retreat into my world on the treatment side of things. And I often tell lifeguards this, but on the prevention side, right? Smoke detectors and fire alarm systems save far more lives every year than the coolest, sexiest firefighter apparatus, therapies and burn surgery and all of that, but it's not as sexy, right?
Right.
And preventing these things, part of the reason why prevention is so important is because we have such a narrow window once we get to treatment to have a successful outcome. And so, yes, lifeguards are tasked with that prevention side. but also the treatment that the lifeguards institute matters more than the paramedics and exponentially more than the doctors. And that's something that I am constantly telling my lifeguards, what you do matters, because it's so easy to think of, oh, these are just the Baywatch. They're out there like sunning and tanning themselves. They're just slackers. We're just going to put you here and hope nothing happens. But lifeguards should be empowered and elevated to know that what they do absolutely matters, not only on the prevention side, which is huge, right? 99.9% of what they do. But then even when it gets to the treatment side, that matters more than often what we can do in the hospital.
Well, I'm surprised they're not defined as first responders, and that should be somehow in the legislation that they are. And so far, I know that they're not, which is surprising to me.
Yeah, and that's something, again, going back to the published medical literature from the CPR guidelines in 2015, there was an emphasis on these systems of care. And lifeguards absolutely meet the definition of EMS in that 2015 systems of care model. And they're often not treated that way from a legislative, from a financial compensation standpoint. And the reality is, whether it's the local country club down the street or the beach lifeguard at the popular heavy surf beaches, they take the same CPR class as the doctors, as the nurses, as the paramedics, and they are held to that same standard when performing CPR. And that's why that training and retraining is so important, with in-service training of lifeguards to keep those skills as second nature in these high acuity, low occurrence events.
Right. I hope you're somebody who's speaking out for lifeguards to be first responders, because you're just such a great person in that regard. I mean, you've had the experience, and now you're an ER doc, and you're a researcher on top of that. I have a question. Next question. What advances in rescue technology or training do you think are most promising for lifeguards in the next 5 to 10 years? Because you're talking about them being the most important first responder in prevention.
Yeah, and it's difficult because, for the most part, the technology associated with lifeguard rescues ha hasn't changed in 50 years. And sure, there's advancements in some of the watercraft that are used, and it's been interesting to see that a lot of I'm trying to think of the politically correct term. I'm going to call them jet skis. I can't think of the politically correct term right now, but jet skis and some of those personal watercraft, those devices have been used to push the limits of where we can perform rescues, right? For the big wave surfers, getting into some of those environments and using equipment that they never would have been able to access those breaks.
Right.
With inflatable wetsuits, with a rip cord, and all of those other things to keep pushing those limits, but that hasn't necessarily translated down to the seasonal lifeguard in Southeast Georgia, in rural South of North Carolina, or some of those other areas. And so I think that having some of that other technology to supplement what the lifeguards do. I know that there's a lot being done on detection systems, and I saw your other interview with one of the AI
Deep blue.
detection, the Deep Blue, some of those type systems, but those don't always translate into the beach environment. And my fear with some of those, and I don't consider myself a Luddite, but those wouldn't be to replace, but to supplement what the people are doing. And it really is For me, the biggest advance that I see in some of the technology is increasing training technology, right? Having actual videos, having actual scenarios that the lifeguards can train on instead of just having to rely on that experience, which is invaluable, of sitting with a mentor side by side in a tower or in a class to read about this is what they look like, because it's subtle. It can be difficult to detect. And having some of those training systems to make us better and more standardized at recognition, I think is going to go far. And again, the toys are out there, right? The drones dropping rescue buoys and things like that. And there is certainly a market for those in some big events. But the reality is a lot of that's not going to trickle down to where it's needed, with more than 90% of the world's drowning deaths in low and middle income countries.
So you're in North Carolina, is that correct?
I'm in Idaho now. I did live in North Carolina for a couple of years, and continue to work with some groups out there.
So let's talk about your global experience. Can we do that? Because
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to know about Lifeguard Without Borders. You've trained communities worldwide. What lessons from resource-limited environments can you talk about? And that applies to Hawaii too. We're stuck out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and things don't come to us as fast, but we have very high level trained guards who practice all the time and train for emergencies. But I want to hear more about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so in 2017, I went to the World Conference on Drowning in Portugal. And by then, I was a medical student and I had all this beach lifeguard experience. And I was expecting to go and hear about the biggest, coolest advances in apparatus and devices and things like that. And there was a speaker from Bangladesh who said that more children die in Bangladesh from drowning than from infectious disease. And more than 90% of the world's drowning deaths are in low and middle income countries. And it just absolutely blew my mind, because I was like, oh my goodness, I'm focusing on people who have chosen to go to a recreational beach in a guarded setting, which is 1% of 1% of the problem. And some of the solutions that they came up with when they did a really in-depth study was most of the drowning deaths occurred from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. within a few meters of the home, while dad was at work and mom was busy preparing food and doing chores for the day. And so the system to reduce drowning was to essentially create creches or daycares, where all of the moms would rotate being the one house that had all of the kids from 9 to 1 that day. Or in some communities, they had a specific building that was, here's where to bring your kids from 9 to 1. And they not only were they not drowning, they were also not falling into the cooking fires, not getting hit by cars, not being bit by animals, right? And all of the other injury prevention things that go with that. And that was just so mind-blowing to me at the time, to try and reframe that. And so Lifeguards Without Borders was born out of that experience with another good friend of mine, Dr. Andrew Schmidt, who went to medical school a year behind me as well. But he and I grew up lifeguarding and kind of formed it together from there. And so, to your question of what are some of the experiences in these resource deficit environments that could translate to Hawaii, and that is, there's just absolutely no substitute for local action, local champions and local heroes. No amount of what we call that, like helicopter in, bring a bunch of supplies and money from the gringos and then leave. It's not sustainable and can often create more problems than you're attempting to solve. And you have to have those local stakeholders who are going to be the champion. And often what that means is not being the the white one percenter behind it that takes the credit for it. And a lot of that time, a lot of the time, we can be a spectacle when we would show up to places, and then there's the political posturing that comes with that. And so we've found more success in kind of some of the silent support behind the scenes of local champions to let them be seen as the person to go to, and not the, again, the 6 foot white guy who's flying in once every couple of years. And so it has to be homegrown in order to be sustainable.
Right, ownership, a
Yeah,
priority. Yeah.
and we did that wrong a lot in the beginning, and learned from that.
Oh, interesting. So, what do you think are the still the obstacles to drowning prevention globally from what you've learned?
Yeah, so the two biggest are, one of the difficulties with drowning prevention is, yes, there's engineering controls, right? Put up the guardrails, but those, some of those things. But when it comes down to it, it's ultimately about changing human behavior, right? There's not a lot of nonprofits out there that are to prevent people from touching hot stoves, because the feedback is severe and immediate. But if I don't wear my seatbelt, I'm probably going to be fine, maybe even for a couple of years. And that can reinforce that I don't really need a seatbelt until I do, right? If I don't put a life jacket on my children, if I don't watch them that closely, if we don't hire a lifeguard when we have a pool party, probably nothing bad's going to happen until it does. When I've traveled and I've taken my 1 2 week vacation out of the year, and I'm going to Hawaii and I'm going into the water at Waikiki, I see all these big wave surfers. It doesn't matter, right? I can fight a bear, I can land a plane, I can return a serve against Serena Williams, right? All of the male ego that comes with that. I'm going in the water, and we have to change, we have to find some way to have our messaging change that behavior years in advance, so that in that critical moment when it's needed, that message is remembered and that message is translated. And the context for somewhere like Hawaii, where you have the cultural locals' experience with the water, where you have the tourists' experience with the water, is going to be different than an ice fishing lake in Minnesota. And those messages are going to have to be different. And then you get to parts of Florida or Texas or wherever, where you have historically low income or minority areas. That messaging has to be different. Now, put that on the international scale. And we worked with a group who was going down to, oh, he's going to kill me for if I get this wrong. I believe the Sudan. They were working on along the Nile. And part of the religious context there was just that dying is an act of God. You can't prevent it. Every family loses somebody to the Nile. So you now have that cultural piece of it has to, you have to understand that. And only a local is going to understand that. Only somebody who truly understands it. And now, how do we set out a 10-year plan to change the behavior of somebody 7 years from now, when they're faced with that moment of, do I go or do I not go? Do I take the boat out even though we don't have enough life jackets today because the weather's killer and I don't want to miss it, and it's 40 minutes out of the way to swing through and pick up another life jacket, right? In that critical moment, have we changed that human behavior in such a way? And that's hard. The hardest thing to do is to change human behavior.
So if we start young, which we're trying to get water safety back in the schools, that appears to me to be the way to do it, or at least try, because you're starting with young kids and it becomes part of their life. And Dwayne DeSoto and Kaina Makua pretty much told me, and they're Hawaiian, that it was how we were brought up. We were thrown in the water and came out, and everything was great, and everybody was always in the water. But economic things have happened. We have to work three and four jobs. It's more expensive living here. Things have changed. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't have water safety back in the schools so everyone can learn that the water and the land is very precious to people in Hawaii. It's very much part of the culture.
And kids teach other kids. And kids teach the parents. The parents don't want to hear it from another adult if they have their own fixed views. But their own kids carry that message home to other siblings. And we see it sometimes as a confounder in some of these studies where you're trying to compare households who received the message versus households who didn't receive the message, because there's crossover of that message, which is what we want. Right, we want those kids to be our little ambassadors going out and sharing that.
You just gave a really good idea that our messaging here should be done by kids.
Absolutely. And again, I think back, and this story just popped into my head, my own experience. I grew up seeing, the public service announcements on don't drink and drive, and I remember hearing don't drink and drive, and then seeing my dad drive with a glass of sweet tea when I'm like six, and I just break down crying, and I'm like, "Dad, the TV said don't drink and drive," and he's like, "This is sweet tea." Like, that's not what the messaging is. But again, that's what we want, right? We want that. Like, what? I don't have a life jacket. What, Mom? Where's my life jacket?
Oh, that's brilliant. It really is. So, you've collaborated with Mike Tipton for many years. What has been the most impactful insights from your joint work? And we'll talk about some other things, but I just thought we'd.
Yeah, absolutely. So, as you addressed head on with Professor Tipton in the interview with him, is that this is a passion project for myself and for many others. And the first world conference, the first kind of modern world conference on drowning, was in 2002. There were some before that some would argue were on that continuum, but suffice it to say, it was 2002, then 2007. And then it was every 4 to 5 years, and we were kind of finally getting to this point where we're like, we have more, we need to meet more frequently. And now it's every 2 years. But around 2000, oh, I'm going to get this wrong, 11, 14, somewhere around there, Mike, Yos Behrens, David Schmilman, Katerina Quiroga, and Jonathan Weber, handfuls of Roberto Barcala Forelos, all of these like excited people were like, we want to meet more often. And so we all met at a conference in Ireland, and literally over a bar napkin, the International Drowning Researchers Alliance was born as a way of saying, hey, so much in academics is political infighting, and we don't want them to get the grant. We want to get the grant. I want to be more prestigious than this person. And so, amongst the highest level group of drowning researchers, who I consider myself the little guy that's standing on the shoulders of these giants, we said, we're going to always collaborate, and we're going to set the culture in this space to always be collaborative and to always work together. And sometimes that's working together to co-author publications. Sometimes that's running things by each other to say, hey, is anybody doing this? I've got a research student that is interested in this. Or, hey guys, this is a terrible idea. You're missing this whole big point over here. And so even amongst our WhatsApp group, we're able to do those things. And so for me, the biggest impact in working with Mike is he just absolutely has that bench research mind of how do we make this into a study, but then how do we translate that into practice, right? As he said, the applied physiology. How do we make this useful and not stuck in a textbook and not, on a shelf in the old paternalistic way where only the academics know this? And sometimes that means doing a semi-scientific experiment where we realize the need to implement this as we're going because the need is so urgent. And sometimes that means we're going to do it really scientific to suss out some of these details. But just his ability to just keep that focus on making sure we have the scientific backing to the things that we're doing and to the things that we're saying in a practical way that we can, that can be implemented immediately has just been huge. And to have him as a resource to bounce ideas and things off of amongst those other in our networks as well has just been phenomenal. But yeah, it was absolutely out of a bar napkin in Dublin that was born to always work together and never against each other in a competitive way.
That is great. I think collaboration is really the key to all this drowning prevention. And the bar napkin, I mean, the napkin in a bar, writing it down is always where great companies and great things happen. You know that.
Right.
So, what's the biggest gaps do you see in drowning research right now? And what questions really need urgent answers? Because it's not a local or national, it's a global issue. So, as you
Yeah,
said,
absolutely. So the World Conference on Drowning is coming up in this November. It's being held in Egypt this year. And through my biased lens on the rescue treatment side of things, we're kind of reaching a point where we know that drowning is caused by lack of oxygen. The treatment is to get oxygen to the brain sooner. But our focus has now really shifted to what about the mental health of the rescuers? What about the mental health of the family when there's a death? What about the mental health of the drowning survivor? What about the mental health of the rescuer? And we're starting to collect case studies and identify, we're really good. That's a stretch. We're becoming more aware at identifying post-traumatic stress disorder in soldiers, in firefighters, in police, and some of those other first responder groups, but not the lifeguards. And they're exposed to some of these same traumatic experiences. And we also published a case study on a firefighter who was a former Marine survival swimmer who drowned and survived during a scuba training exercise, who then experienced significant PTSD afterwards. So not only on the patients, the rescuers, but then what about the families, right? For every we often in our world like to think of drowning as a community problem, as a community disease, because that one drowning death, not only is it often a child or a younger person, but you've got parents, siblings, spouses, huge networks left behind to cope with that sudden loss. And we don't understand the problem well enough to know the size of it, to then kind of start addressing, here's the best way to mitigate that. And so there's groups such as ILSERA, oh, I'm going to get this wrong. So many people are going to be mad that I forgot all these things. The International Lifeguard Critical Incident. Oh, and their website's down. Something. But yeah, groups to look at and identify some of this in
Are they
those
going to
three
be at the conference?
populations. They will. I'm presenting something with them and then working with an international group on a survey that I will send you the link that you can put in the show notes. So if there are any professional aquatic rescuers out there, that the survey will run until July 2026. We launched it in July 2025 on World Drowning Prevention Day in hopes of having it run for a year to catch both northern and southern hemisphere peak seasons for lifeguards. But any lifeguard who has or has not experienced critical incidents through the course of their work to better understand that incident. So from that side, that's the big research gap right now. On the prevention side, you know, it's eternally the what is the most effective messaging, right? Is scaring people with gory stuff more effective than being gentle? And you know, the answer is it depends. And so, you know, trying to find those magic bullet viral moments of messaging is always so difficult.
Have you done any research on that? Like focus groups, you know, give them some messaging and say,
Yeah, I personally haven't, but there are many groups. There are many groups that have, and specific to drowning, there's quite a bit of that as well. Quite a few studies on messaging and what works and what doesn't.
really? And who has done those? Do you know? If you do, let me know. We'll put that down also, but be interesting.
Yeah, I'll send it to you. There was a group in Australia and a group in New Zealand that I know of that did them. And you know, the too long didn't read of that is basically the more the, not the scarier, but the more frightening messages tend to resonate better. But again, your target audience is 14 to 29-year-old males who, as a former 14 to 29-year-old male, I can tell you that we are very stubborn and difficult to get us to change our behavior, so much so that we often re refer to the inciting event of a drowning as testosterone poisoning.
That's what you were saying. Yes. So you talked about this, which I think is really important, the need for a consistent beach lifeguard data collection system. And you did some research on that, right? You did some research with Portugal, Brazil, New Zealand, Australia, and the USA. You were part of an international study. Were you part of that research?
Yeah, and you know, part of it is to our roots go back to out of hospital cardiac arrest in general. And it may seem silly, but what is survival? What is a good outcome? What is a bad outcome? How do you define all of these variables? And there have been specific large conferences around cardiac arrest in the early 90s, and then now in drowning since 2000, on the need for consistent terminology so that we can compare apples to apples. And the one of the biggest examples that always comes to mind is if I'm working as a beach lifeguard, somebody goes under a big wave, we pull them in unconscious with no pulse. We do CPR and send them off to the hospital, then they are pronounced dead 3 minutes, days, hours, weeks, or months later. If their cause of death is listed as respiratory failure and cardiac arrest, well, then it never gets captured in the drowning statistics. If that person survives and is discharged, they might never be diagnosed with drowning, because they didn't die. And so we need to be able to speak the same language, to track the same data, to even identify the scope of the problem, especially as it relates to non-fatal drowning. Fatal, we have, there's the CDC and most states have better systems for that, but really capturing some of that non-fatal data, which, as I mentioned earlier, can be 4 to 10 times as much as the fatal data, is the challenge. And then what defines a rescue? What defines some of these other things. And so the purpose of that study was to try and say, kind of, here's a dictionary of terms that researchers can use so that we can all speak the same language.
Are they using them? I mean, are people now using all universal terms? Like, can you give me an example of what the terms would be that some people are using differently?
Most commonly what we see is with the idea of near drowning, dry drowning, delayed drowning, and secondary drowning is most commonly what we see. And then the difficulty with from a medical standpoint, if the lifeguards rescue someone who has respiratory distress, who then goes to the hospital, and 95 to 98 I'm sorry, 95 to 99% chance they're going to survive. They survive, they go home, and they have no long-term complications. From a medical definition standpoint, that person has drowned. If I'm the lifeguard agency, I don't want to say we had 100 people drown this year, right?
Right.
Because 95 to 99% of those did fine, went home, and had no complications at all. But if I'm advertising we had 90, 100 drownings at our beach, people hear that as you had 100 people die, your beach is unsafe. What are you even doing out there? And so translating what works for medical researchers and epidemiologists into what works for the PR and the city council and all of those becomes infinitely more difficult. And that's not to say that one group is right or wrong, but we have to be able to compare these things and have this framework for this is a non-fatal drowning, this is a fatal drowning, this is what counts as a rescue that didn't tip over into becoming a drowning, whereas most agencies would report everybody they pull in as a rescue.
Right.
And then to take that even a step further, the vast majority of what lifeguards do is prevention, and that can be the hardest thing. How do you measure something that didn't happen today?
Well, you've just said drowning is a process, and drowning
Right.
doesn't mean you die. Those are really important pieces of information. And so you're right. People think a drowning is like this horrible thing. Somebody died. So, right. That's
Yeah.
the only thing being reported, not any of these others. So you don't have data to work with. So maybe you could do a pilot somewhere that would report those things. I don't know.
Yeah, and there are groups that there are groups, and Australia has really led the way, as and their big organizations have full-time epidemiologists, full-time PhDs that are constantly collecting and analyzing that data and putting together national reports that that do a much better job of identifying the fatal and non-fatal drowning incidents that, serve as a model for others.
Can the United States learn from that?
Yeah, absolutely. And the CDC has certainly has gotten much better. Dr. Tessa Clemens has been with them for probably 5 or 6 years now. I'm getting old. Has just been a phenomenal resource for taking that somebody experienced in the drowning specific world into the highest epidemiologic levels, instead of it just kind of being oh, well, here you go, you're in charge of drowning also.
Right. Well, that's good to know. So, what would you say if you were designing the future of lifeguarding and drowning prevention? What would it look in 20 years, Dr. Justin?
Oh, absolutely. Higher paid, better trained, and everyone has all lifeguard agencies have access to oxygen and to physician medical direction.
Oh, well said. So, what would you say to our listeners, to our community? You've been talking a lot about parents. So, what messages, what can you restate again from this great interview that you'd really like our listeners to understand about prevention? drowning.
And so take an age-appropriate CPR class, meaning if you have kids, take a child CPR class, which every child CPR class will include training for rescue breaths as well. And then, drowning is the process of drowning is silent, and there's not splashing and yelling like there is in the movies. And so use pool fences, locking doors, because it really just does take those momentary lapses, and you have to have layers of protection as well. And then the backyard pool parties are a common one that we see as well, where every adult assumes that someone else is watching. And if you don't hire a lifeguard, then use a water watcher, which, if you do a Google search for water watcher, there'll be a dozen different tags that you can print out or order, but it's basically just a laminated card and a whistle that says, I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, I'm not talking on the phone. While I have this tag on, I'm the one watching the water, and I'm not going to walk away until I hand this to another responsible adult to then be responsible for watching the water. And you set up a schedule for every half hour, every hour, or whatever, if there's going to be if there's a pool. And even if they're not intending to be a pool party, especially if you have a cover that obscures the pool, that it's just so common. And then when you are going out on the water, life jackets, and when you're going to the beach or other open water, check with the lifeguards, check with the experts on what those local conditions are at that moment. No matter how much groups, very, very well-educated researchers have tried to create online app-based rip current wind tide models, there is just so much data that cannot be synthesized into those to give you a green, it's safe in this one exact spot where you've set down your towel. And you have to rely on the experts and really check your ego that, okay, if they say it's a bad idea, I need to go with that.
Yeah, well, that's really good advice. Bruce Hopkins came on and said how he's dealing with rip currents is he's actually taking people into them.
I love it.
I thought it was great because people here said, yeah, I'd like to do that because everybody's afraid of getting in one. And then everybody says, stay calm, but that's not an action. So
Right.
floating is what you're supposed to do. So it was kind of an interesting concept. So maybe we'll figure that one out. Your
Yeah,
conference. Yeah, go
that'd
ahead.
be fun to put a bunch of, yeah, again, you take a handful of people, pair them one on one with a lifeguard, put them in a life jacket, and take everybody out in the rip. Because I mean, that's what I did when, in my rookie lifeguard training, or even, when in Florida, when we would go body surfing in the big nor'easters and such like that. If somebody like found a really nasty rip, then we were all like racing down there to go jump in it, to jump in it and goof off in the shore break. So
You're not
yeah, that's
supposed
how you
to.
get the experience.
Yeah, but don't give that as a message here. It's literally. So your summit or conference is going to be in Egypt?
Correct.
Is that just open to people, experts in the field, right? It's not like a summit where anybody could or somebody could go, right?
Yeah, there's many people that just go as attendees as well. So it's
Interesting.
every 2 years now, the World Conference on drowning.
Okay. All right. So can you send me your resources on that and the survey so I can pass that around? I'm sure probably the Hawaii Lifeguard Association may have that. I don't know. But I'm talking to Kalani Vieira, who's president of the Hawaii Lifeguard Association, after this interview, and I'll find
Oh,
out.
excellent.
Yeah. So I can pass that on to him. And then anything about the summit and any other resources you want to put for our show notes for this would be wonderful. I just appreciate you coming on and giving us the current research about what you've been working on with Mike Tipton and other people and your experience of being a lifeguard, a medic, and an EMT and now an ER doc is like, you have such great perspective on everything. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. And then the only other thing that I had in my notes that I do want to mention real quick was the Hawaii Water Safety Plan.
Yes, I gave that to
And
you because our governor said if we all took it and read it and took it to heart, we could save lives. So.
I would just, absolutely commend the effort. So I was one of the rescue and CPR chairs for the U.S. National Water Safety
Okay.
Action Plan. And a couple of the things that I absolutely loved about the Hawaii one is it's readable. It's
Yes.
interesting,
Yes.
right? That I keep coming back to that we have to take it from those highest levels, and
Right.
it's no good if it sits on a shelf and nobody reads it.
Exactly.
And then the other side is it's very clear that it's Hawaiian, and it's very clear that that cultural context is considered. And I was speaking a couple years ago with an indigenous group from New Zealand, and they were saying that all of the studies in New Zealand were talking about how amazing all their water safety messaging was. They were getting 5 out of 5 stars for everything, except in the indigenous community, it just fell flat on its face. And the reason was it described the water like the enemy that should be avoided, or like going into combat against this thing that's trying to kill you. And they said that didn't resonate because water is life. We
Yes.
go into the water for food sustainability, for recreation, for exercise, for raising our kids. The water is not our enemy. So you posting these messages in our community that the water is the enemy didn't land. And again, the very first thing on there is water is life,
Yes.
right? And it
Yes.
just I that like absolutely hit me as the again, this is what a summary should look like, right? This is the context, the number, the marquee numbers, and then again, for the people that are going to read the whole thing, it goes into the details. But I absolutely loved that about this.
Oh, good, because I felt the same way. I keep telling, it's a readable document and a working document. You know, you can write something, but if it sits on a shelf, it's worthless to people. So I just want to keep working with this to get as many people on talking about different things. So thank you so much for that, you know, t your feelings about the water safety plan, because I thought it was well done also. And the fact that you are on the United States water safety plan. I understand that that was the first time ever that we've ever had a United States water safety plan. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. So it came from about 5 years or so ago. That was one of the charges from
Right.
the World Health Organization and the UN was to create a national plan.
I was kind of shocked by that other countries had water safety plans and we didn't have one, right? Well, thank you for that, and thank you for your comments on the water safety plan. That'll help us to go further. And let's stay in touch. I want to know how your conference goes in Egypt. Maybe you can come
Yeah,
talk
absolutely.
about that. That would be really kind of cool. That's going to be when?
In November, it's right before Thanksgiving. I don't have
Well,
the date in front of me.
That's really soon. We might have to have you back on and talk about it. Is Mike going to that?
absolutely.
Is Mike Tipton going?
I'm not sure. I'd have to check our group chat. I'm not sure if he'll be there or not.
All right. Well, thank you for the time you spent today. I really appreciate you coming on. I know you're really busy, but you gave us a lot of very good information. And it's really important to collaborate and to really move forward with drowning. You know, as you said, drowning prevention isn't sexy, but it's something we have to do.
Yeah, absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay.